All right, everybody, welcome to DEF CON, the DEF CON 10. We're here today talking about the DC Front Home Project, something we've been working on. My name's Chris Davis. I'm with Red Siren. I'm a CISP. My focus mainly is penetration testing, vulnerability assessments.
Your screen over there's not working.
Oh, I know. This is the presentation screen that was going to be for demos, so look over here. I don't know who's running that show, but
we would if we could. Can anyone turn off that light?
The plug's over there behind the curtains, so.
Maybe, please. Excellent.
Hey. All right. Thank you, man in purple shirt. Like I said, my name is Chris Davis. I do pen testing, vulnerability assessments. I've been working in InfoSec for about 5 years now. I've been doing computers in general probably since I was born, pretty much.
My name is Aaron Higby. I'm a consultant with Foundstone. I'm out of the Washington, D.C. office, and most of the time I do attack and penetration testing for our clients. Chris Davis and I actually met while working at Lucent as part of their professional services organization. And while Lucent isn't doing so well, so we both kind of parted ways, but we've continued to hang out and work on security-related projects together. Like I said earlier, my main focus is attack and penetration testing. A lot of times, I've been called in to do an insider pen test, where the client wants me to be inside with just an Ethernet jack and see exactly which information I can get to. And one time in particular, the client was interested in finding out if I could get physical access into the data center. So I was supposed to be posing myself as a normal employee, but they wanted to see if I could get into the data center while I didn't have access. So I heard about the old crawling over the ceiling, through the ceiling tile, so I said, hey, that sounds like a good idea. I'm going to try that. Well, I was able to find an adjoining office area that had a wall that was right next to the data center, so I decided to try this out. When I looked in this office, I saw a table, a desk, and a rolly chair. And I needed to get up to the ceiling. I didn't bring a ladder with me, so I decided to put the rolly chair on the table, and I do not recommend that to anybody. But for the most part, it worked. I was able to remove the first ceiling tile on my side, and then I said, okay, well, now it's time to jump down to the other side, and that's when it hit me. That's a lot easier said than done. So I removed one of the other tiles, I slide it over, and then in the process of actually heaving my body over the wall, I break two of the client's ceiling tiles. So I'm not going to be able to patch the ceiling. They know that I was in there. It was quite a chore to actually get in there, but I was in. I didn't have a laptop with me or anything. It was hard enough just to get inside. So my next step was to find some server that they would think valuable that I could gain access to. So I walked through this data center for a while, and I'm not familiar with it, but I think I find what's the payroll and accounting server. And then it took me about 5 or 10 minutes to find that. And then I decided, okay, well, I'm going to try to log into it or do something to it. It took me about another 5 or 10 minutes just to figure out the KVM. Finally, I was in there long enough to say, you know what, they're gonna know that I'm in here. I broke the ceiling tile. There's stuff all over the floor. So what I ended up doing was just leaving a business card so I can put my final report, yes, it's possible to gain physical access to the data center. But what I really wished I had was my laptop or something that I could have done or something that I could have left there to give me access later.
I actually had a similar situation. I didn't leave a business card, though. I took that and a couple other personal items that I don't think they wish I could have taken. I was doing a pen test for a physical pen for a bank a while back, and they had four levels of access control just to get into their data center. We're talking the DataWatch cards and some biometrics to get back there. And so I was thinking, geez, am I going to get in? If I'm going to get in, I'm not going to be there for long. So fortunately, I was able to listen to this guy's voicemail at the company for a while, pick up his voice imprint. I called the secretary, said, hey, yeah, let this guy through. And she let me in. I'm like, great, this is awesome. Unfortunately, she also called an escort down for me. I had to use the bathroom, obviously. And in the meantime, went around, had some fun, went through their knock. But unfortunately, I only had about 5 minutes there. you know, even though I sat down and read this guy's email, you know, modified his presentation he was working on for some client, you know, it still didn't work out that well because I didn't really do that much while I was there. If I had something that I could have dropped off, left there, had it do the work for me and just go home and wait for something to happen, that would have been a lot better. And that's the stuff we're going to be talking about today, a concept we've deemed 180-degree hacking, also known as phone home. We've done it on a few different platforms right now. It's not limited to these platforms, but these are the ones we've done it for so far. Use your imagination. I'm sure you guys can think of tons of different ways that you could use this. We're also going to demonstrate it for you, and we're going to tell you how to what you might be able to do to stop it.
Throughout the presentation, we're going to throw out some names of tools that we're using and maybe some links. We went ahead and tried to collect all of that information for you on our website, dcphonehome.com. It was slash dotted, and it's running off of our DSL line. So if anyone would like to help host it, we would appreciate it. Then you can actually go and check out the content. But we have collected for you the links that we're using, some documentation, and also the x86 bootable CD for you to download. This some basic assumptions that I hope everyone here is familiar with Linux, networking, VPNs, firewalls, proxies, and other hacking tools like Nmap, port scanners, and other things.
Yeah, even though this is the 101 class, it's not really a 101 topic. You'll be able to get it. It's not a hard concept. The thing we're attacking is the conventional enterprise security model where you have your firewall, you have your DMZ, you got your private addressing and your NATing. Some companies, some organizations are starting to go towards higher levels of security. They're watching their networks with their IDSs. They're only allowing in authenticated with tokens for remote access. They've got proxies up so they can filter URLs, mainly porn sites. They're doing content checking on their email, prevent viruses. They're hiring people to watch these things, and they're also hiring consultants / experts for, you know, to help them fix their problem. But all of this is in our experience, and is the years that we've been doing this, the same thing we've been seeing over and over again is that networks really have this hard, crunchy outside, and it's really soft, chewy center.
So all this focus seems to be on the perimeter, the intrusion detection system, the DMZ, the private NAT. You know, the data that's valuable, that's worth protecting, is on the inside. And so as a side effect of putting all of our efforts in protecting the perimeter and keeping bad guys out, networks generally, in our experience, have been very vulnerable on the inside. So we want to get to the inside. The problem with building a soft, chewy inside and a hard, crunchy outside is that we're forgetting that networks go both ways. They go in and out. Traffic can pass. When you have a company, you need your employees to be able to access the internet. They need to do research. They need to send email out. So they do have a data path in order to get information out and to exchange information. Another thing, even hackers are focusing primarily on the security with the latest vulnerabilities. How can we get into the perimeter? How can we exploit the next zero-day buffer overflow and set up a BNC for IRC? So what are companies using to help protect the perimeter? What are they using firewalls for? Well, mostly to enforce inbound traffic rules. We only let these ports into our organization. We only let these ports into our web servers, into our DMZ. A lot of people are using the firewalls for NAT, which does help out for security. People just can't contact their internal hosts directly. People are using the firewalls for authentication, VPN gateways, lots of different uses.
Another thing people are using are proxies. A lot of times it's used for performance enhancement, you know, web caching proxy. If everybody's going to like Yahoo every day, you know, you don't want to send that many requests over and over again. Proxies, unfortunately, they don't have much in the way of protection except with URL filtering or some dirty word searching. Also, at the same time, these proxies, if a company makes an attempt to make a proxy, or if somebody out here wants to code a proxy that actually checks the content, we're talking XML or HTTP content, they have to check a crap load of stuff. The W3C has a lot of protocols that they're already enforcing or they're already recommending you use. They're also developing a lot more, and so proxy manufacturers, developers, actually trying to keep up with this pace, it's a hard thing to do. Another thing that we're attacking is the network intrusion detection piece. Again, in our experience, is focused on the perimeter. Some companies do set it up so that they've got multi-layered, multi-points of presence on their network on every segment. But a lot of places don't want to spend the money to put these up all over the place. They want to set one right next to their firewall, listen to all the traffic, and be aware of all the incoming attacks. Another problem with NIDS, though, is that it's based on signatures. It's based on a predefined attack, and so it leaves out things that are unknown. Some companies are saying that they've developed anomaly detection technology, but by definition, an anomaly is undefined. So how do you define that? Go ahead.
Okay, so we're attacking the soft Chewy center. Most people believe that outbound connections that are initiated from their internal organization are trusted. They're sent from employees who are trying to do work. And there's a general notion that outside traffic coming in is bad, and anything leaving the network is good. So we want to somehow be able to take advantage of that to get to the data inside. Another problem with internal security these days is most of it is directed toward network devices, to servers, to the NT farm, to the domain. And the problem with that is there are a lot more than just computers on your network. There's many things that are capable of being very powerful computers that can launch attacks. I don't know if you caught FX's talk, but he showed some really cool tricks with a printer just to prove the point that these systems are capable of more than just what they were designed to do. And so when we're looking at internal security, we want to be aware that other things on our network can be used as an attack point. One thing that I read two or three weeks ago, I think it was on Security Focus, was about there was a security paper about the Xbox and how the Xbox can potentially cause a threat to the internet because millions of Xboxes will be deployed on people's broadband connections, and someone may figure out a way to use those as a denial of service attack tool. And after I got done reading that advisory, I thought, wow, that's got to be the most boring, unimaginative thing I've ever read. You got a computer on someone's network, and the best thing that we can come up with is to take down eBay? I think there's something else missing here. We could probably do a lot more of that.
One of the things the folks on Slashdot failed to understand when they were going on their comments about what we're doing is that we're really attacking an idea of what computers are. Okay, I mean, our definition of a computer is a general-purpose architecture. Anything that has a chip in it that's general purpose can run malicious code, can run attacks, can be made to do anything you want pretty much because, well, it's general purpose. So the 180-degree hacking, the crux of the biscuit, our main question is why even hack the network? Just bring it home. Make it easy on yourself. It's based on a couple things. One, firewalls are pointless. I'll come back to that in a minute because some of you might disagree. Two, it's based on a delivery mechanism, whether it's physical delivery of a system, whether it's a zero-day exploit or some vulnerability of a system that you can exploit and deliver some code on. It's based on the internet, tunneling, VPNing has to flow over the internet. It's a beautiful thing. It's also based on getting people to do things that they don't think they're doing, con jobs. Now, I did say firewalls are pointless. I fully believe that in this attack, firewalls are. What we do is the attack is based on using an authorized protocol that your organization or your firewall is configured to use to allow the pass through. We're using that to get data through. Some people talk about covert channels in this type of mechanism, in this type of context, but it's we're getting a lot of bandwidth. We're not just getting a couple bytes here and there. And it's firewalls, two-way, let data in and out, so we can take advantage of that. Go ahead.
One thing Chris mentioned was physical access as being a delivery mechanism. And what we want to get across is physical access is pretty easy to obtain, especially for short amounts of time. If you think about where you work or where you've been in, it's probably not all that hard to get into an organization for 1 or 2 minutes. So if we had something, if we were able to get that access for a short amount of time, maybe if we had something to drop off, we would have a data path back into the network. And what you're really limited in gaining physical access into an organization is your creativity. Those are your only limiting factors on getting inside.
We have some slides for you to show just how simple it is.
Well,
to walk you through the process.
Just so you can get a clear picture, it is pretty complicated here. Now, what we have here, we like to call the super stealth method. Okay, And here, this is where the black cat lives. So he's got his black hat on. And, well, interesting enough, the internet comes through his window. We're not quite sure how he did that, but he did. And what he is intending to do is he's going to leave his home, okay? He's walking, okay, into the front door of your company. And he's going to walk by your intrusion detection system, by your DMZ, by your firewall, and onto your internal network. And he's going to put this thing there, and he's going to go home.
We actually tested this against the NIDS, and it never showed a single alert.
Not a single packet is used. Very stealth. Okay, in this example, our black cat's a little more timid. He doesn't actually want to go in. And maybe he looks funny, maybe he'll stick out. So what he decides to do is he leaves his home and he goes to the mailbox. And he has things that he's going to mail. And see, here's the postman. He's coming. And he's delivering to Bob and marketing and Sue and HR something for everyone to put in their PC. And of course, everyone's going to put the Elvis CD in their PC because, well, it looks like Elvis. That's pretty cool, right?
Everyone loves Elvis.
So there they are, putting the Elvis CD into their PC. So that's another way to deliver something into the network without using a single packet.
Another way, and this is somewhat of a little bit better known method, something we call the smoke screen. You know, I'm a smoker. I don't know how many of you are smokers. I bet probably a good 90%, given the audience today. But, you know, we're trampled on. We're told to get out of places. We're told to you know, that we're killing people. We're told, you know, not to come close to me. People in L.A. will come up to us and cough in our face just to show, they're probably sick. And so because of this, you can form a really quick bond merely through the presence of a little stick of tobacco. You walk up to the back door where the smokers are hanging out, they're having a good time, you strike up a conversation, they give you a light, they give you a smoke, and they let you in the door.
It's really very effective.
Another way to do it is to prey on people's kindness, prey on compassion. If you're carrying a big box, you're stressing under the weight of this thing, even though all you've got inside is, well, a Dreamcast. You know, you're just straining under the weight. Somebody will open the door for you. Someone will hold the door for you. Even if there is access control on it, most times people will be nice enough to do that. Another way, some organizations do have a policy where they encourage their employees to confront and to ask people that they don't know that they've never seen before, you know, who are you? What's your badge? What do you do here? Well, a really easy way to get around that is just talk on your cell phone. It would be extremely rude of that person to interrupt you and to actually ask you, you know, who you are.
And since you're holding the phone, they generally open the door for you because, you know, that's the nice thing to do. Okay, so assuming you don't want to do any of the physical access hacks, which are generally easier and more stealthy than you can imagine, you can always rely on the zero-day exploit. There will be another one that will come out that will allow you to get some type of data in, a Trojan horse, or something like we've developed today with the 180-degree hacking that would allow that software to establish tunnels back. The other guys are familiar with zero-day exploits, so be creative.
So after you deliver this thing, after you deliver this device, what's it going to do? It's going to discover your network. It's going to discover what's on it. It's going to enumerate what traffic you can get out. It's going to see what port you're allowing through your firewall. And then it's going to create a tunnel home and establish the connection. Similar things, not as comprehensive as what we're doing, but they use some of the same ideas. Peer-to-peer file sharing. That is pretty much a virtual network between two endpoints that allows you to share files, chat, you know, stream content. Chat applications, such as AOL Instant Messenger. Can you guys hear me better now? Sorry about that. Chat applications, such as AOL Instant Messenger, it will try to get out 5190. If it can't, it tries port 80 with HTTP. If you can't do that, it'll try your proxy. Same thing. Also, there are remote desktop apps. Go to mypc.com. It's pretty much VNC with a bow on it. You know, you go up to a site, you register, you download some software, install it on a client PC, you connect, you go home, you log into the site, and there's your desktop. And it's free for the first month.
Okay, so a little bit more about what our devices do and the process that they go through. We mentioned that we did it on the iPac and an x86 bootable CD and the CD-ROM, but they all do the same thing. What they first start off doing is they automatically get a network address via DHCP. So that would be one way to stop this. turn off the HCP or at least have some type of port-based access control. We'll take questions afterwards. The next thing it does is it figures out what outbound traffic it can get out onto the internet. Now, we're assuming that not all outbound traffic is let out. So what we do is generally we've been on a lot of networks, and for the most part, we check the ports that are allowed out. 80 is usually allowed out if it's not proxied. SSL, UDP 53 is sometimes allowed out. Sometimes the port 20, the FTP data port, is allowed out. Certain types of ICMP are occasionally allowed out. So what happens after one of these things boots and gets an IP address is it goes out and it checks Google on port 80. And if it can go to Google, it writes into the info file, yes, I can get out on port 80. And it basically builds a configuration file of all the protocols and the access points that it can get out of the network. Okay, so then another process gets kicked off where that is analyzed. And basically, if it can find a TCP port out already that's available, it'll start a VTON session back home. And it'll build a fully transparent VPN back to our home system that will allow us to get back on that internal network. So let's turn it up a notch a little bit and say 80's not let out. Okay, 443, it'll try that. And if it can get out, it'll build a tunnel there. If it can't get out on any of those TCP ports, it'll see if it can get out on DNS via UDP 53. If it can get out on that, it uses SIPE to build a VPN tunnel over UDP back to our home system. If it can't get out on that, it tries ICMP. And if ICMP is allowed out, then we use ICMP tunnel to build a VPN back to our home system. Now, let's assume that this network has done some due diligence and they've locked down all the data paths except through a proxy server. So we go to the next phase, which is the proxy finder. And what will happen at this point is it'll try to do a zone transfer internally on the internal DNS that the DHCP gave, and it'll write all the names to a file, but maybe that won't work. Maybe zone transfers are locked down. So then it'll go ahead and do a reverse lookup on all the IPs on the subnet or on the network that it's on, and it'll write that to a file. Then it basically greps for things that we like to name our proxy, like proxy, squid, cache flow, pretty much what we, gateway, something that we use as a proxy. A lot of people name their proxy servers that. And then it'll go ahead and port scan those proxies to try to find the proxy port, whether it's a squid port or 8080. And if it can do that, and it can find the proxy, it'll then start HTTP tunnel, and inside of that, it'll wrap SSH and PPP and build a full VPN back through the proxy server. And if it can't do that, then it's sad face and it didn't work.
So what types of delivery are we talking about? We've talked about drop-and-go hardware. We mentioned that earlier at the beginning of the presentation, the Dreamcast. We've done it on a compact iPack. We've got a bootable CD-ROM you can slip into an unused system, or maybe it's after hours on a Friday afternoon, and there are a couple people wandering around. They're not going to be back for the weekend. There's always the remote exploit. But a question that we've been asked and that we've asked ourselves many times is, why did we pick a Dreamcast?
We really wish we did not, but we did. So
it's a pain to work with, but one of the big reasons we picked it is that it's innocuous. It's a toy. It looks like a toy. If you bring it into a company and like some head honcho VP comes up and says, hey, look at the Dreamcast. My son plays with that. It's fun. They don't think it's going to hack. Another reason is that it's cheap. You can get, or you used to be able to get when we wrote the slides, everything for under $100. Right now, since the Slashdot article, you're going to have a hard time finding the broadband adapter because everybody else is. It has 10/100 Ethernet. That's the broadband adapter I'm talking about. It's got a really powerful processor, believe it or not. And we heard Linux was running on it, and we wanted to try it out. What a good use. Dreamcast is based on the Hitachi SH architecture. Similar things that use that are the HP Granada series. We could probably port a lot of this stuff to the Granada fairly easily. It's at a pretty fast speed for this type of stuff. We're not dealing with a 5 megahertz processor. It's limited to 16 meg of RAM, which made things really difficult. It has no writable storage. It does have a Realtek Ethernet adapter, full Linux compatibility. And the keyboard was helpful for typing stuff sometimes. So.
Yeah, and imagine developing this and living off that one backtick in the shell script that makes it not work. Well, guess what? You get to burn another CD and fix that error. And so that can make a pretty painful development process. I think Chris must have gone through over 150 CDs to
easily
get this thing going.
Easily, just last week. building the distro, we had the, there was a group, shlinux.org, where they had a lot of RPMs that we could take and throw on there, you know, build the whole file system from ground up. We had to add a lot of our own things, though, because they just weren't compiled for it yet. And actually getting things compiled for that, we had to put together a cross-compiler. We had to make sure that the versions of the compilers were compatible with the glibc version that's on the Dreamcast. It turned into a big headache, but we got it working, thankfully. We had to patch the kernel. The 2.4 series does have SH support, but it doesn't have everything you need. It's not the most up-to-date. If you're going to do this, I recommend using the latest. There hasn't been a lot of development either, except from shlinux.org, which they release stuff every 6 months to a year, because, well, it's you can't really get it from at the store anymore. Go ahead. Another thing we did this on was the compact iPack, as we like to call it, the iHack. We use the model 3765. You can use it on any model, pretty much. It's got a strong ARM core proc. That's been supported in the Linux kernel ever since 2.2, possibly at the patch level before that. It's got quite a bit of RAM, much more than the Dreamcast did. It does have flash ROM, so you got writable storage. We could get the dual-slot PCMCI expansion pack that also has a battery, so we got extended battery time as well as expansion capabilities and interfaces that make development a lot easier. Go ahead. As I mentioned, it's been in the kernel since 2.2. If you go to handhelds.org, there's a lot of people actually developing for handhelds because they're sick and tired of having Pocket PC on their handhelds. And so there are a couple distributions for the iPack in particular. We used Familiar. The release at the time was version 0.5.2. We were able to get a native compiler on the system to actually work with code on the system and test it right then. Development went a lot faster on this than it did on the Dreamcast.
Okay, we realize that everyone's got a spare Dreamcast laying around or an iPad to play around with. So we thought, well, you know, we could use any computer, really. Trinix is a really cool Linux bootable floppy distribution, but they also do have an ISO. So we basically ripped apart Trinix, put our scripts on it so it could run on any PC. We wanted to make sure that we included the PCMCIA core so it would run on laptops as well. It's about a 20 meg ISO. It should be included on the DEF CON CD. So we encourage everyone in this room to burn that ISO and put it in their systems and try it out.
Please use it. We want to see what your networks look like.
What it doesn't actually phone home, we promise. What it does do is when you, we promise. what it does do, I'm going to give you a little fair warning, is when you boot it, it's going to try to contact Google. It's going to try to contact Earthlink's SMTP. Thank you, Earthlink. It's going to try to contact CSC's DNS server. It's going to try to ping Google. It's going to write all that to an info file for you. Then it's going to try to find your internal proxy server. So it will do a zone transfer attempt on your internal DNS. So if your DHCP is handing out an external DNS, be forewarned. And then it's going to write all that information, and it's basically going to tell you, hey, yeah, this will work. We're able to get out on these protocols, and we're also able to find your proxy server. Here it is. So that's a handy little thing. If it's not on a DEF CON CD, we were told that it is. We will have that available for everyone to download so they can test out their networks. Trinix was nice to develop on. It uses a 2.4.5 kernel. So IP tables and all that we needed to use worked fine. It was easily modified with the help of VMware. I didn't have to burn an ISO every time. VMware's got a nice feature where you can point it to a CD, an ISO to boot off of. So that's how I did all the development with it. I took the ISO apart with some software, pointed VMware to the ISO to test it when it didn't work. Rebuild the ISO. It didn't take that long, but VMware was a big help in building this.
Didn't you only burn like one CD?
I only burned it once.
Jeez, pastor.
Some of the tools that all the platforms have on to do their enumeration and there is DHCP, of course. There's Netcat. There's Nmap. We also put a lot of security tools on the platforms for you. So if you want to do SSH back into your device, the phone home, all of these are fully capable of running DSNF and FOSS, and they're all capable of RB directing and sniffing switches. So if you wanted to do that, the idea was if the proxy was authenticating, we would have some tools there that would help us figure out passwords to use the proxy. We also put tunneling apps on all of these CDs. VTun, we really got to put our hats off to the developers of these software suites. They did an excellent job. SIPE, HTTP tunnel. We then started using proxy tunnel, which is another similar concept at proxytunnel.sourceforge. ICMP tunnel, S-tunnel, PPP, and SSH. And another thing that really helped us out was the Building Linux VPNs book, much better than the how-tos.
Yeah, that's actually one of the reasons this whole thing started, because I was working on a couple chapters of that book while Aaron was doing a pen test. And so it was like, wait a second, we can tunnel out of their network. And so the evil thought started running.
Some other basic tools are on the CD. So phoning home simplified. You deliver it somehow. Exploit, you walk in, you do something. It boots, it figures out the network, figures out which traffic it can get out on, starts a tunnel home, and then allows your home system to get back to the internal network that it lives on.
So now we have some demos for you, probably one of the things you guys want to see.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I'm going to just run down the lab for everyone. It's pretty complicated. This system in the middle here is our firewall, and there's different network scripts that we have on it to simulate networks that are more open than less open, and the ones that are restricted only via proxy. All of these things do basically the same thing, the Dreamcast and all the other distributions. So what we're going to start off with is booting the Dreamcast and tunneling home. Now, the idea is it can find a TCP port, and the Dreamcast will be able to tunnel through the firewall back to the attacker system. Chris is the attacker system. Now, we're kind of limited on projectors here, so we wanted to put the Dreamcast screen up here, and then he'll switch over to so you can see that the tunnel was created.
Right. We're going to show you one side of the attack, namely the inside on the Dreamcast, and then for the other two, we're going to actually switch to my system where we can see the tunnel being received. So I'm going to go ahead and, just as a preface really quick, like we were talking about earlier with delivery, you pick it up, you put it down, you plug it in, and you turn it on. So,
which is pretty cool. A VPN that works automatically and only has one button.
Yeah, we're hired sometimes for like 2 months to get VPNs up and running. So we're not going to tell them about this. It's probably better that way.
So this should be familiar to you all?
This is the Ecos bootloader Red Hat puts out. I think they've stopped development on some of their GNU Pro Tools. But as you can see, it's using BootP right now to grab an address. It's going to be loading the different. It's going to be loading the kernel and the initrd image from different segments on the disk. It's all scripted right now, so it boots automatically. There'll be stuff flying by there sometime fairly soon. It's not fast, I'll tell you that much. It's like a 2x CD-ROM. There's our little penguin.
Okay, so the Dreamcast is right now it's a basic network configuration that's NATed. Some outbound traffic is blocked, but it's going to find a TCP port that it can speak out on. You can probably get in and out before it's done booting.
Yeah, this is a typical boot up sequence. I think it's enumerating the network. No, not yet. It's looking for networks now. That's what it's find and open. It's starting the tunnel sometime soon. As you notice, it's saying can't find device TUN 0. The VTUN uses the TUN tab driver built into the kernel, and what I did is because the Dreamcast isn't necessarily the most reliable mechanism, I sit in a loop trying to establish the connection over and over again until it finally is established. Now, as you see, it's established right then. We have IP addresses. of the 10.0.1 network on this side. Now that you guys have seen that's established, I'm going to unplug and put it in my laptop.
Okay, I'm the victim host. I'm on the corporate network. I have an internal 172 address. But now that this tunnel is up, Chris can route through it back and get any of the hosts that are on the internal network in the smack dab of the Chewy Center. We want to ping or...
We're up yet? Okay, sorry, it's a little bit hard to read, but right now I'm going to be pinging. First, I'm going to ping over the tunnel.
So if you see the text go like this, it's working.
I'm going to ping over the tunnel. As you can see, we're scrolling up. Those are ICMP packets.
So their internal network is now joined with ours.
Now I'm going to set up a route over that to the other side to ping a host on the 172.16.101.0 network.
What happens once it is able to establish the tunnel, it takes all the network information that it was got during the initial enumeration phase, and it spits it back through the tunnel, so that way you know the IP address scheme of the internal network that it's sitting on, so you can set up the routes easily.
There's my route. I'm being accepted. Now I'm going to ping 172.16.101.51. As you can see, we have packets scrolling on the bottom. So we have connectivity now. Firewall, our rule sets are based on what we want to define. We've circumvented their network devices.
Okay, so that was a pretty basic network. Hopefully not all networks are just letting out random TCP ports. Chris is going to move over to the firewall now, and he's going to turn it up a notch. He's going to block all TCP traffic. He's going to make it so the devices can't get out of a single TCP port. And the idea is we're going to use the IPAC on this demo. And what it's going to do, because it won't be able to get out on any TCP ports like the Dreamcast was, is it's going to figure out that it can get out on a UDP port, and it's going to build a side VPN back home.
Now, as you can see up on the screen, I've got a script that will run my, run a SIPE daemon. On the mothership here to listen for the IPAC's SIPE tunnel over UDP 53.
Okay, the IPAC boots a lot faster than the Dreamcast.
I'll hold this up for you guys. You're not going to be able to see a damn thing on here except when the screen lights up after it's booted. little blinking light, it's reading from memory, so that takes a few seconds. And we're on to boot. Unfortunately, a couple days before the conference, I plugged this NIC card into a voice over IP port and fried it, I think. It's been a little bit flaky here and there, but I'm pretty sure I got it working for you guys.
We had to bash it earlier.
Yeah, we had to smash it. The light's on. There's my little penguin. If you guys can see that. I'm going to put this down now.
We'll have all this stuff up here if you want to come check it out afterwards.
Now, if you watch the SIPE window up top, right up here, I'll blow it up a little bit. The type's not going to be any bigger. It's waiting for the tunnel right now. As you can see, it's pinging the internal side of the network. It's pinging the 172 right now. The tunnel's up. It's ready to go. All happens automatically within, how long is that, 2 minutes?
Yeah, so just like the Dreamcast, full access from the attacker system onto the internal network over a UDP-based VPN that this initiated. Okay,
one other thing really quick. The nice part about this, if I turn this off, like it's not even on right now, and I turn it back on, the nice thing about SIPE is that it's a stateless tunnel. Since it's running over UDP, I can turn it back on, and I can ping 172.16.101.61. And there's my ping. So I can even turn the thing off and turn it back on, and it's still up. That's one of the really nice parts about it.
Okay, so we want to bring this up a notch. We've tunneled over TCP. We've tunneled over UDP. So Chris is going to change the firewall rule set here to say there's no way you're getting out of this network unless you get out on our proxy server. And that's where we're going to demo the x86 Trinex bootable disk. And I'm going to get ready to do that here. I'm going to do it on my system in VMware because we didn't want to cut down another laptop.
I actually turned off routing altogether on this box. All this thing is right now is a proxy server. It takes in one side, puts out the other.
You all set?
1 second. Yeah, I'm ready to go.
Okay. I'm going to power this on, and I'm going to put it in full screen mode. Hopefully the projector will not object. It's going to be on this screen. So the idea is here, maybe there's a kiosk or a scanner station that's neglected, or maybe you can drop this CD off at night. This would make any box capable of phoning home. So it'll boot just like Trinex does. It will unload some standard packages, some NMAP, Netcat, some other tools that we're using, SSH. It'll unpackage the package that we built that has all the network enumeration scripts. Once it'll do that, it'll try to get out on TCP ports, and it just failed. It wasn't able to get out on any TCP ports. So now it's going to try UDP ports. It failed there. It wasn't able to get out on any UDP ports. Now it's going to try ICMP. No, not ICMP, so it's starting the proxy finder script, and it does work kind of fast over this local network here.
Now, the way we had to set this up, since when you're running PPP, you have to run it in a pseudo terminal. Are we up yet? We have to run it in a pseudo terminal, so we actually had to set it up to run. We couldn't set it up to run through a script because it's not attached to a terminal. So we had to set it as attached directly to one of the TTYs, remove the Getty, remove the login prompt, just run it straight out of there.
All right, the tunnel's up. Now, this tunnel is going over the proxy server. So it's going through the proxy. It's running SSH over the proxy server, and inside of the SSH, it's running PPP to build a full tunnel back home.
Does anybody want to see a ping flood over this connection?
It gets a little hairy, but it works. This will work against any proxy server that uses Connect. And so most any proxy that you're sitting behind that lets you go to an SSL website uses that feature.
I want to show you guys, I've been ping flooding it for the past 5-6 seconds. We've lost about 20 packets out of 16,000. It's a very stable connection.
Okay, another nice thing about running it on the pseudo terminal is if it dies, you know, HTTP sessions do time out. We want to make sure we can get back on our tunnel in the event that either SSH times out, the firewall times out, or HTTP times out. So because it's on the terminal, it will restart itself every time it times out.
So those are our demos. Hope you enjoyed them. We got to wrap this up sometime soon, so we're going to go on to remedies, possible remedies, and then some questions. As a general conclusion, I mean, the best way to defend against this type of attack is to constrict the data passing your network. Don't try to prevent it. Don't try to turn everything off. It's not a business function. You can't turn things off. But you can just constrict your data path to single paths. Your web, obviously going through a proxy, sure will attack that. You can add other measures, such as strong authentication, to that to prevent against that. DNS, move it in-house. Let the DNS server in-house forward out. Your email, same thing. Have it in-house. Don't outsource that type of service. You could try, and some of these recommendations that were given, nothing really exists for them yet, but would love to see them exist someday. So we kind of recommend them. A full mesh internet VPN technology. PGPNet was trying to do it. You could maybe possibly do bulk encryption. That would only prevent against drop-and-go hardware, though. It would not prevent against somebody exploiting a vulnerability in your system, shoving some code on there and tunneling home. Switchboard security, again, only against drop-and-go hardware. A lot of places aren't doing this. A lot of places are just letting anybody plug in. We'd love to see an IDS that knows our network better than we do. We'd love to know that the IDS is able to know what data is allowed to be there, what data isn't allowed to be there, down to the byte level. We don't want an IDS just searching for signatures. We want our IDS to search for or to know when there's a problem in our network. We also need proxies that can really analyze the protocols. Again, earlier we discussed 30-plus protocols that W3C has in development that, you know, how are you going to write a proxy that can filter all those? Well, time's got to be spent. We have to, you know, invest the money to actually get those things working. And one of the things we didn't really talk about is that, but the IPAC, we have a fallback mechanism if it can't find a route out or a proxy out or anything like that. But if you've got an air gap in your network, we can throw a wireless card in here, have it act as an access point, you know, fall back to that capability.
What's interesting about that, and a lot of the Slashdot crowd is saying, well, if you're going to go into a building, why not just put an access point there? And, you know, I would think, you know, since a lot of the topics this year have been about finding access points, we thought, well, yeah, that's kind of an okay idea. So in just tinkering around, we figured out a way to make this into an access point, but we put the actual card services on a timer, so Chrome doesn't actually start the radio until about 2 a.m. or on the weekends when the company's not looking for rogue access points. So, yeah, it is possible. We also have a great idea of throwing a GSM cellular modem card into one of these things. That way you could actually phone home or phone into this system without having to sit in the parking lot. So, I mean, what's going to stop that? Wireless jamming, maybe? Or how about firing people that put up rogue access points? I'm there for that.
If you don't want to have an access point in your network, just jam the thing.
The problem where it sits right now is covert channels, there's always a possibility that they can exist. If data has to leave the network, if people inside of your organization have to get out to get data, there is a possibility that someone may potentially build a covert channel over that. The way that we have to tackle that is to restrict our data paths and be able to granularly look inside and notice, hey, this guy's got a proxy connection for 3 days. He's constantly sending traffic. There's probably a problem there. Another problem with this type of attack here is most average person off the street isn't going to go try to sneak a Dreamcast in an organization. But the people that are doing this are people that are targeting the organization specifically. So they may have a lot more information on the company than that would help them or aid them in getting in.
One of the last things before we wrap up. One of the other reasons we picked the Dreamcast as opposed to other hardware is, you know, if somebody does get hacked with a Dreamcast, it's going to be the funniest damn thing I've ever heard of.
So your network is hacked by a single Dreamcast. It is the new axis of evil. Okay, time for some questions. This guy had one. We definitely considered that. The thing we wanted to really show, the question was, instead of using DHCP, have we tried to do traffic analysis locally on the network to figure out the address so you can assign one yourself? We did think about doing that, but it was kind of moving away from the focus. The focus we wanted to do was building tunnels out. It would be very possible to do that. There's a fine gateway tool that comes with the older DSNIF suites that would really make that easy to do. So, yeah, that's definitely a possibility. That's something that we could have coded in here, but for the most part, networks have DHCP as far as that we've seen. Question?